I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is with the book world phenomenon, Rafe Larson, who will be known any day now for a first novel with words and pictures and marginal notes of the highest style and originality. The book is The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. But even before the books were in the store, Rafe Larson was known for striking it rich at age 29 at a moment when books and surely big money in the publishing world were said to be over. Rafe Larson got just under $1 million for the U.S. rights to this Spivet book about a prodigious map maker in Montana who's only 12 years old. You can marvel that Larson is a hit before he's 30, or you can marvel that he's put 29 years of his life into thinking and living and producing this book. In our conversation, I thought, before you get to know T.S. Spivet, let's get to know Rafe Larson at his parents' house on the Cambridge-Somerville line near Boston. Rafe Larson, everybody's talking about the making of T.S. Spivet. I'm equally interested, I must say, in the making of Rafe Larson. How did this happen?
How did I happen?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the big question about how do we happen. I mean, it's a extraordinary collision of nurturing and naturing, I think. But we're sitting here in my mother's studio, which is a good place probably to start. We're surrounded by these floating bodies, models, against various black and white backgrounds, and my mother has projected images of science onto their skin, so that their skin almost becomes the image. So right there, I think you can look at how I became fascinated with the scientific diagram. I have some working theories about why I and others are kind of obsessed with these diagrams and with sequences and kind of this categorization.
I'm sure you have a list of 10. Let's hear it.
I think one of the reasons is obviously the completeness and the sequentiality and the concreteness of how a diagram maps meaning onto the world. I love looking at the airline safety carts, and you get that step-by-step sequence of how to put on your mask and then how to put on your child's mask. You know, it seems so... so reasonable in a time that no doubt would be so terrible. But I also think that, like stories, diagrams inherently gesture at the incompleteness of the image and remind us of how actually complicated the world is beyond the realm of that diagram. So it's this double gesture of comforting us and reminding us that we know nothing.
Well, isn't it all in that diagram on page 32? In the marginal note, there's a picture illustrating the distance between here and there. There's here on one side, there's there on the other, and between them, there's 3/4 inch representing terra incognita.
Yeah, and I think the key there is the 3/4 inch, right? We still have to measure the unknown and know exactly how long it is. But I like that diagram too, particularly because it is so appropriate for childhood. You know, I think at one point T.S. talks about how becoming an adult is kind of transitioning the unknown into the known. And obviously when kids are constantly surrounded by the unknown, and that's why they're terrified of things and why they have so many questions. And gradually over the course of development, we begin to replace the complex world of textures and light around us with a pretty sad but workable system of symbols. You know, so we stop actually looking at a lot of things and replacing this with a table and this with a chair and you with a man and you with a woman. And that comes preloaded with all the kind of cultural assumptions we have. And my father, who is also an artist, said that a lot of what he spends his time with, particularly with beginning art students, is just getting them to see like kids again, kind of shedding those symbols and being like, let's actually look at how this cloth folds over a chair, or the way that the leaves actually have two sides. You know, we never think about that.
All this is interesting to me because people see your book as a kind of, not only a publishing 10-strike, but a kind of perfect confluence of of many things, I suppose. It could be, you know, David Macaulay's How Things Work, or Griffin and Sabine, or Dave Eggers's Gifts for Cartooning, or the graphic novel. So many things have come together in the selected works of T.S. Bivitt. But on the other hand, when reading it and getting to know you a little bit, it strikes me, no, you would have done this anyway. It's remarkable that you did it at 29, but this book is 29 years in the making.
Yeah. I mean, I've been asked, where did this book come from? And people want to just like, I was on a horseback one day and it just came to me. But of course, creating a novel is such a messy thing. And again, it's like you're picking and choosing from your entire experience. I think a lot of what being a writer is just knowing how to keep your eyes open, you know, and knowing how to have the net in your brain so that things keep getting caught and you know how to pluck them out.
I'm interested in how you learned it and who taught you. All the more because you're teaching now and you may teach forever, but you've had extremely self-conscious teachers as well as your parents along the way. And I want you to tell my kids, my grandchildren, you know, what's this process about?
I think it began right here in these studios. I have these very early memories of just watching my parents at work in the creative process, you know. And I would remember my dad, he would get very close to the canvas and kind of take a look at it at there, add some brush strokes, and then move back and survey the scene and kind of constantly do this. And then he might throw the canvas out, you know. So I think I was given permission from an early age to let things be messy. And muck about, which I think is a really important stage of any sort of creative process. I, like a lot of beginning writers, when I started out writing, was absolutely terrified with how poor the quality of sentences that would first come out of my mouth would be, or my pen. They were just kind of terrible teen fiction, you know. And so I would quickly try to brush my tracks and make them nice and, you know, polish them up. But I think as I've learned, you know, how I write and the process of writing, I've learned to let the stinkers lie for a little bit, and be confident that somewhere down the road I'll either toss it out or I will polish it up and so it gets that literary sheen. But the important thing is to trust the mucking about phase, and so I think I saw that pretty pretty firsthand, you know. And I was fortunate enough to go to Shady Hill School, which when I went, at least, and I'm sure this is still true, was a really safe space to muck about. In fact, I looked at some of my second grade stories, and they weren't that far from this book. I mean, they were in those like little books with on the bottom of the page, you had the three lines with the dotted line running down the middle, so you had to, you know, make sure your lowercase letters hit the middle of the hit the middle line, and then above you were just supposed to illustrate. So every page had an illustration. And I remember I would just write crazy stories about, like, Egyptians coming down from space and, you know, learning how to drive. You know, they discovered cars and they were driving cars up their pyramids. And, I mean, you should probably talk to my second grade teacher. You know, they're like, they had to, like, rip the books out of my hands. So it's interesting that you say that this seems like a natural progression, because in many ways for me, I was like, oh, of course. You know, I wasn't like, how can I think outside what's been done? Particularly for this story, I didn't set out with any real formalistic goals in terms of I'm going to write a book with diagrams exploding everywhere. I was really trying to write about a character. And almost all the formalistic choices I made in here were either narrative-based or character-based. It wasn't like I first set out with form and then tried to match the content with the form.
Go back before this book. What was the aspiration? And when I saw the line in the book where Spivitt's mother tells him, mediocrity is the fungus of the mind, I wondered, where did the aspiration begin and what was it? Did your mother ever say that to you?
No. Probably, thank God. Yeah, and that was one of the nice things that my parents did, was that they got it early on that I would get super motivated about things that motivated me. And no one could kind of push me into that that format. I mean, that's how I've always been, is that I if something gets my fancy, like, I'll take it to the hilt. But the kind of busy work, you know, I'm not so good at. And I've been fortunate enough to go to places that honor work that you're really motivated and give you space to expand and follow your little rabbit holes to whatever really motivates you. And I when I teach, I try to listen to what are the voices calling out to the students, and how can I set up a project so that they can follow those. I think so many schools have such a rigid system, you know, which may be in there for various probably good reasons, that really stifle allowing kids to kind of find that little morsel that gets them so excited and then kind of explode into whatever their talent is. So I feel so fortunate to have gone to a number of places that allowed that kind of mucking about in creative room. You know, they didn't kind of chastise me as this strange kid who would write a 23-page paper on ants. You know, they're like, good on ya.
Go back to Shady Hill for a moment. You introduced Lois Hetland last night, who was your teacher, and I had the pleasure of meeting her. She's chock full of theories about how this stuff works. Did she tell you? Did she show you? Maybe you taught her. You say in the book she taught you almost everything you know.
And there's many days that I feel like that. I mean, I had the good fortune of having her in seventh grade, and we just clicked. She got me right away. I've had a number of teachers who have just gotten how my brain works, and I could picture a parallel world where that wasn't true, where I was confronted with Mr. Stenpak in the book, who kind of said, you know, just do your lessons, you'll do fine. But Lois kept pushing me, and I just kept in touch with her. And she moved from being a seventh grade teacher to getting a PhD in you know, theories of development and learning theory. And she worked at Harvard for a number of years, where I interned with her at Project Zero, and we got to teach a course together, which was one of the highlights of my life, where we talked about using painting and visual image in the classroom and exploring creativity through that way. And we did it. It was a little symposium we did for school teachers, and it was just so great to finally teach side by side with my, you know, one of my teaching heroes.
What is the theory?
Well, she could probably talk about it much more. But when I was actually at Brown, I worked on a project called the Arts and Literacy Project, which placed actors into middle school English classrooms. And in Providence, you probably know, there's a huge variety of ESL kids there, because it was an old mill town. So they have, you know, Dominican populations and Cape Verdean populations and Colombian, and, you know, from all over the world. So the, for such a small town, it has a really diverse student population. And a lot of them struggle in the kind of formal English classroom. If you just did The Metamorphosis or Othello, just taught it straight on, there would be a lot of disconnect. But the Arts and Literacy Project uses the toolbox of the creative process, the toolbox of drama, to get these kids engaged almost from the back door. So they break up their curriculum into five or six components, and the first one is entering the text. So how do you get a kid who might have all kinds of hang-ups about what academics is and, you know, what, how they fit vis-a-vis that kind of system, how do you get them suddenly connected into a story? Which for me, who's a storyteller, that's it. That's the linchpin. How do you get people who, I mean, I think storytelling is so universal, you know, as has played out over the course of history. How do you get kids beyond their, you know, their teenage hang-ups, their cultural hang-ups, the language hang-ups, to just buy into a story? And if you get them hooked, then you can do like all kinds of amazing things. I mean, if they're willing to open themselves, open that doorway, you can suddenly, you know, talk about character, talk about language, talk about, you know, verbs, nouns, adjectives, talk about their own stories, get them to update the stories. And so I'm, as a teacher and as a storyteller, I'm interested in how do you crack open that door?
Is there a classic story that does it? I mean, when you think of one, by way of example.
You mean when I was working in the Arts and Literacy Project?
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons. There was this one kid who, you know, he was kind of a big guy, and he knew he was big, very quiet. He was Dominican, and he the first probably five classes, he didn't say a word, and sat in the back of the room with his hat down, and I forget what the key moment was. I think they bring on all kinds of mediums, artistic mediums, and one day the artist, the Arts and Literacy Project artist, brought in drums, and you could see something change in this kid. I mean, even the way his hat came up and he started excitedly talking with his friend, and there was still some resistance, but you know, when the overeager kids offered to play the drums and they couldn't really play, you could tell this kid needed to show them, and he came to the front of the class and started playing this amazing samba beat, you know, and all the other kids were like, oh my god, you know, he can do this. And suddenly he became the key part of this. I'm trying to remember what the text was. It was a Shakespeare play. I think it was Romeo and Juliet. And so their final project was to to do a kind of street version of Romeo and Juliet. And this guy became the drum player. I mean, he was the centerpiece of the final performance, and he loved it. I mean, you could just see, and even at the end where they did this a tableau where they'll do this thing where they'll be like Romeo, and then everyone would have to take on a frozen statue position of Romeo over the course of the play, and I think he was the one who yelled at Romeo, you know. And so it was these kind of breakthroughs are what is what I think we all know that the arts are so important, and we've seen it, you know, all the time, you know, arts turn on kids, but to be able to quantify it and to actually see it happen is really amazing. And I actually worked with, sorry to launch into another story, but one of the people that I studied in college at the education department was Shirley Bryce Heath, who is now a professor at Brown. And my first job out of college was working with her in England. The British, who support the arts from a governmental standpoint much more so than we do, had just passed this £16 billion initiative called Creative Partnerships, which put across, I think, six pilot cities across the UK, put artists into schools in a long-term partnership. So, which was really key. It wasn't just a one-off where you bring in the actor who juggles and is like, "Hey, kids, you know, we all love to act," and then leaves. Right? It's not that kind of horse and pony show. It's these kids work with an artist on a project that lasts, you know, at least 6 months. And so Shirley brought me in as part of her field research team, where we were actually measuring how kids' language changed when they worked with an artist in a long-term format. So I was in there with my tape recorders, and we were doing all these linguistic counts. We were counting the number of open-ended questions a kid would ask in a traditional classroom versus working with an artist, you know. So the types of open-ended questions they would ask, I mean, you know, you've been around artists, you know how they talk. It's like, what material should we make this sculpture out of? Like, do we have enough money for that kind of thing? Does this represent the school? There was one project in particular I remembered, which was, it was a sculptor, and the school had commissioned him and a group of students who signed on with him to design and commission and build a sculpture that would go into the courtyard of this school. It was like a pretty rural public school, although they call them private schools there, I think. It's backwards. And it was just so cool to see this kind of, these kids, again, first they were kind of wondering, what do we do? And as soon as you raise the stakes, as soon as they feel like my work is going to matter and something that is going to come out of here that other people are going to see, already you have them, because they know, okay, something's on the line here. And we would also look at things like hypothetical speak, you know, how many times kids talked about the future. We could do this, we could do X, Y, Z, but then we can't do Z because, you know, that would be too expensive, or that's whack, or what, you know, whatever it was. And this kind of high level, you know, hypothetical conditional talk, I mean, we would play it back for the teachers and they would just be amazed. I mean, these were kids who were doing yes and no answers, you know, and, you know, getting them wrong in their classroom. But of course, if you look at the kind of talk that goes on in a classroom, and you look at the kind of talk that goes in the hallways, I mean, kids are talk at a very high level, you know, and they use metaphor and simile, and they take on personas, and they use irony, and they have all kinds of overlapping talk. So Shirley's so good at pinpointing the way that people speak and read in a variety of contexts beyond the classroom. And from a writer's standpoint, going to England and really closely listening to the way that people speak, I think is a really beautiful thing. I mean, when I teach, I often have my students record dialogue transcode it and actually map out how people speak, because I'm sure you've done this, and we talk so weird. You know, we don't talk in complete sentences. We interrupt each other. We trail off. We think the transcript in our head is being played out loud. And so
we never answer the question. We never finish the sentence. We never complete the idea. It's astonishing.
No. And so I tell my students, I say, well, if this is how we actually speak, and in our heads, we fill in the blanks, and so we almost come out with full sentences and full ideas. We kind of know what we're talking about. Then our job on the page is to approximate human dialogue in a way that really does not resemble how human dialogue happens. I had one, I think it was Meredith Steinbach at Brown. She said, never have one end of a line meet another. Always have people just missing each other.
Back to T.S. Piven for a moment. He and his creator are kind of a great showcase of multiple intelligences. He has an impulse to turn everything into a diagram, whether it's the city of Chicago or those gorgeous train yards in Nebraska or Washington or all those other categories of stuff. But the book is also a great exercise in multimedia. Where did this come into your world?
Yeah.
Starting with the multiple intelligences, the fact that this prodigy works at so many, intuitively, impulsively, obsessively, at so many levels.
Well, it's interesting you bring up multiple intelligences, because I think actually, I use this term too, and it's a good shorthand, the word genius or prodigy, you know, which I'm uncomfortable with, I think, a little bit as I use it, because it's one so culturally loaded. It comes with all this kind of baggage about we have these cultural archetypes, and one of them is the cowboy, and one of them is the child prodigy, you know? And I wrote T.S. very carefully in that I endowed him with certain extraordinary skills, to be sure. But in other ways, he's very much 12, or even younger than 12. He has this amazing ability to spatialize the world and in trying to figure out, you know, why do people make these facial expressions? Why does my brother make this overemphasized fist pump?
As I remember, there are 42 units of thrust that make every facial expression or something. Yeah. He doped this out.
No, this is actually the facial action coding system was developed by Paul Ekman, who's a real doctor.
He credits Paul Ekman, yeah. I should have said.
Yeah.
You credit Gene Autry for the 10 rules of cowboy living.
No, those are real too. Those Gene Autry created those.
Well, I say you credit him.
Oh, I credit him. Yeah, I credit. Yeah. So a lot of the stuff is real in this book. Yeah. So what's interesting is how when we encounter a child who possesses a couple extraordinary skills, we immediately think that they can do anything. And I think often this reveals a little bit more about ourselves and our hopes and dreams than the actual kid. Like there's a scene in here where he's getting an MRI by a scientist who's doing this project on child prodigies, and she's kind of scanning his brain to find out what part of his hippocampus is overactive. And she gives him this really difficult math equation, and he's kind of staring at it, and he's like, you know, lady, I'm in seventh grade. I've only done pre-algebra. You know, this kind of assumption that suddenly he can do anything, you know. So, yes, he possesses a certain things, but I think like the rest of us, he also can't do everything. And I think that that's a really important part of his character.
But what does it say about the multifariousness of the mind, and especially on this maybe oversimple division between print culture and screen culture?
Yeah. Well, maybe this goes back to when I was at Brown. And when I first got there, Robert Coover, who's a big hero of mine.
And of mine, yeah.
Was very much on this hypertext kick, which I think was very much tied to the hyperlink, and like this was early I was at Brown in the late 90s, but it was still this holdover from the great excitement of the internet, and one can click on this word and it will link to a whole new thing, and we were very excited about these possibilities. And I was too initially, but I found that often people got so excited with the form of linking that they actually forgot some of the tenets of storytelling. And so I almost got this kind of allergic reaction to bells and whistles and, innovations in form just for the sake of innovation. And in that way, I think I'm a pretty, old-fashioned storyteller, in that I have plenty of friends who are doing way more experimental, non-narrative stuff than this book. So I believe in some of the tenets of the old great storytellers, which is like character, scene, narrative. These are the things. These are how we get our tender hooks into readers.
Yeah, but you've complexified it. For example, I was wondering, one can't read the book obviously without getting lost in the marginal notes and the drawings. And Spivet is writing a lot of both. What are the differences between his voice in the margin and his voice in the text? It's not as simple as telling a story, because he tells different parts of the stories in a different voice depending on where.
Yes, yeah. No, so you have me. You've got me. And in some ways, of course, the great irony is that this is essentially an exploded hypertext book. So that I've come back and I've thank you, Coover. is the moral of this? So yes, I wanted this the tenets of narrative and character to be in place, but within that format, I found originally all of the subtexts were in footnotes, and I almost had no images the first draft.
That's where Juno Diaz puts them.
Yes, and I have a kind of love-hate relationship with footnotes. I think they have a really tangled history in fiction. And some writers, like Nicholson Baker, and some of David Foster Wallace's stuff, it really works. But often it's this kind of authorial intrusion where the author's like, I know much more about this. Like, let me tell you more, And even the format of a footnote of breaking the narrative eye, where you have to go down to the end of the page, or like, God forbid, endnotes. There's a real, it's almost like a pompousness from the writer saying, you've got to do this, reader, And as someone who's interested in narrative and how we read and how we form stories in our head, the footnote didn't feel right. It felt too, it didn't feel right also with T.S. wouldn't have liked it. T.S. is a spatial thinker. He would have seen the page as a sort of map. So at some point in the process, I made this really key breakthrough where I was like, they're not footnotes, they're going to be marginalia. And I think the real from a reading point of view, the real breakthrough was the arrows, because suddenly you're following a kind of diagram, you're following a map, but you're also doing a lot of lateral movement, which mimics at least in Western cultures, the eye of reading, of how the eye reads. So I think that is key. And as you said, I quickly found there was a really key relationship between the main text and the subtext, or the sidebars, in that T.S. is almost most comfortable in these exploding diagrams or in these annotations, and he's willing to make observations or risk a sort of emotional literacy that he wouldn't in the main text if it's tucked away. He kind of dips his toe into the pond of adultness sometimes, and is willing to make this kind of risky reveal, I would say, often, and it's the last line of a sidebar. So kind of seeing how these two things react with each other was really interesting from a writer's point of view. And pretty early on, I wanted the reader to know, oh, I can't skip the margins.
But did you back into this and discover that this was the way your own head was working, or did you choose it? I would have guessed that you stumbled on it. Wait a sec, there's more to say here from another perspective.
I stumbled on it because I was writing T.S.'s character. And I don't think I would have just done footnotes for footnotes' sake. I think they really came out of T.S. I knew T.S. would say something and then he would want to say more. And I was struggling before with how to capture that kind of Russian doll type thinking on the page without totally disrupting a reader's experience. When I had footnotes, there were probably 10 times the amount of digressions that are made in the final book.
Mm.
So I really had to be, I mean, in some ways, moving to marginalia was an editor's best friend, because I had to really scrutinize, okay, what's doing work here? What's just a jokey sidebar, and what's actually going to advance the story, advance this character? So that, I mean, writing any novel is like an intense act of selection, but even this one more so than others, I think I had to really, because I knew that every time I asked the reader to travel the sidebar, I was throwing another ball in the air. So I was cognizant of that, and I didn't want to overwhelm the reader.
This makes another point about the book, that it's a very fluid thing. Remember Donald Regan saying that the Reagan economic policy had been written on a word processor, like, you know, here today, gone tomorrow, or we'll change the whole damn thing? I have a sense that this thing is a very, very movable feast for you.
Yes.
The whole enterprise.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I started, because as soon as you start illustrating one thing, then you can illustrate kind of almost anything. And I actually cut a lot of images out. When I put in an image, it would suddenly be doing narrative work, so I would cut out some text. Like there's an image of the dinner table conversations. And, you know, before and after this kind of tragedy happens. And I had this whole paragraph about how at the dinner table, T.S. really struggled with talking to his father. But suddenly with that image, it's like you don't need it. You know, it was doing it in a lot simpler and I think more elegant way. And as it's a difficult thing as a writer, because I think there's this simultaneous gesture of wanting to nail down the text, wanting to have it right, but also, again, being comfortable with the fluidity that you're talking about. I mean, this text was fluid for 4 years, you know, and it was kind of like, you know, that, you know, those things with those bubbles floating around, and you had to you tilt it this one way, and everything changes. And to be okay with that, it takes a sort of guts, you know, and also stupidity, maybe, just being like, okay, this will work out. Particularly, this is my first book. I have no idea how to write a novel. There were many days where I was like, what am I doing? This is like a 300-page glorified bedtime story. You know, no one's going to want to stick around. And so that you have to have kind of faith that, you know, if I move around the water enough, that it will find this kind of equilibrium. I mean, I also had great readers who kind of clued me into how the relationship between the margins and the main text was working. But a lot of it was a leap of faith, I think. You know, this could have failed miserably in terms of how readers, they could have from page one been like, this is too much, you know.
I had the sense, hearing you read from it, that the thing is still in process. It's still out there. Not a blog exactly, but it's still forming itself, and it's forming itself on your website. It could form itself in a different way in a film or in video. I mean, again, maybe the examples are your mother's combination of science and human figuration and art, but where is this thing heading, and when do we get the last edition?
Well, it may feel that way. I mean, I think, you know, Paul Valéry, the poet, said that a poem is never finished, only abandoned, you know. So I think I have to abandon this at some point. And I actually have abandoned the book. I think it's where it needs to be. One interesting thing that we did was that there was an afterword to the book, which answered some of the internal questions that are brought up at the end. The end kind of leaves you in this question mark of what was actually real, what happened, what's, you know, and I originally had it where, you know, you turn the page and you get all the answers, and I decided to cut that because I wanted the reader to float in that space a little bit longer of, okay, what, trying to make sense of this world. And what I've done is I've migrated that afterword to the website and chopped it up and turned it into a bunch of different media. Some of it's in video, some of it's in letters. And then kind of hidden it so that for the reader who wants to figure out, okay, what's the story behind the book, what some of the more meta questions, they can go to the website and become a kind of detective. And I think, you know, a lot of people ask books, you know, they're a dying species, they're dying creatures. And I really don't think so. I mean, I think the book is such a genius technology. I think physically they're really well designed. How you know, just how humans are set up, how we have laps, how we have arms, how we like to touch things and turn pages. And even how, at least for me, the reason why the Kindle is not quite there yet is that when I recall something in a book, I think of where it was on the page, like upper left, and like a third of the way through.
Right.
And ebooks collapse that geography, at least now. I mean, they might figure out a way to do it better. But a book like this, they're not doing a Kindle version because they can't do a Kindle version right now. So it's interesting. I'm interested in what are the future of books, and I think this book and books like it have a place in that future, which is the book as artifact, you know, the book as a book that cannot be translated into another media.
Mm.
That said, I think I tried to do with this book is, and I think what books will have to do in the future is begin to have more of a productive and rich conversation with the media around them. So more and more, I think you will see companion websites to books that start to do more than just tell you where the author is going to be, but actually are in dialogue with the story and maybe bring out a piece of the story that wasn't well contained within the covers of a book, but maybe could be contained within a multimedia presentation. The big challenge for us as storytellers is how do we mimic the evocative, deep, bounded space of a novel, like that feeling of when you're knee-deep in a novel on the internet, which is, by definition, a million miles wide and 2 inches deep, you know? Like, we all know that feeling of spending an hour on the internet and chasing these rabbit holes where you're like, oh, she's dead. Oh, I didn't know he was married. And like, oh, yeah, that movie sucked. You know, that kind of like, just like one carrot after another, and there's no real deep knowledge or deep storytelling going on. So how do you combat that as a writer, you know? How do you combat the tendency to follow the endless hyperlinks?
When you think of 10 books that formed you, where you can remember the place on the page where somebody died or fell in love, who were they? What were they?
Oh, that's such a hard question because there's so many. I'll start with a couple children's books, because that's where we all start. But there was this wonderful book called No More Jumping on the Bed, where a kid who lives on the top floor of an apartment building jumps on his bed, and his parents keep telling him not, that he'll break the bed. And and he, after they close the door at night, he just does a couple more jumps, and the bed falls through the floor and then starts falling through every floor of the apartment building, and he starts taking all the tenants with him, and they all start falling. And it was one of those wonderful books where you could see, like, the fish in the bowl who starts out in the bowl and then kind of ends up in the cake, and then, you know, those kids love those kind of tracing those through lines. And I love, and then he comes to the basement, the dark basement, and then he wakes up and he realizes it was a dream. But I love, there's a kind of wormhole there. So that was one of my favorites. There was another book called The Maze, where it was like an old black and white, beautiful lithographs, where you would follow, it was like a choose your own adventure, but no words, basically. A doorway would have 24 on it, you would have to go to page 24, and then you would be confronted with three more doorways. And you had to figure out how to get to the center of the maze. And it was, I'm not sure I ever figured it out. More contemporary books. I think, you know, there are a couple books that I read and I was like, oh man, I gotta be a writer. And definitely some of J.D. Salinger's short stories were like that when I was younger. Like Raise High, The Roof Beam Carpenters, and Franny and Zooey. Jeffrey Eugenides' Middlesex was one of the contemporary ones where I listened to it actually all on tape. And I was driving across the country, and I had this like real kind of epiphany where it was just this collision of landscape and story and the guy's voice. And I was like, I need to recreate this moment for somebody somewhere.
Mm.
And then, you know, some of the more classics, Heart of Darkness, Conrad is one of my favorites, and Garcia Marquez's 100 Years, the way that breaks all the rules and yet is such a perfect novel. Anna Karenina, you know, some of the Russian Gogol's Tales. I don't know, the list goes on and on. I think I want to position myself somewhere between the magic realism, although I kind of hate that, of South America, and the strange, overexposed surrealism of Balkan Eastern European literature, like Bruno Schultz or some of the writers that have come out of Bosnia and Croatia. And my next book actually is about an underground troupe of puppeteers who travel around to places under siege and perform strange, surreal puppet shows about particle physics for the masses.
Alexander Heman on your list?
Yes, yes, yeah.
Here's my longer question, and I didn't want to get into the marketing of this book, but here we are in what feels almost like a depression. The publishing industry has practically dissolved. Everybody says, you know, Philip Roth, our leading novelist, doesn't have a publisher, or his publisher has virtually gone dark. And a 29-year-old kid that nobody had ever heard of 6 months ago is making big money and a hugely important book. What's the moral of that story?
I'm in the thick of it right now, so I don't think we can write the end of the story just yet. The story of how this book came to be was I really listened to the project. I mean, I think that, you know, as creators, I know that we're subject to market forces and, you know, the media and all the rules of where we are. But I think I wasn't afraid to break certain rules in this book because the book demanded that certain rules get broken. I mean, from something as small, but as actually really, it's really big, as the trim size of this book. You know, when I was shopping this around to publishers, I asked, because I laid the whole book out in 8.5 by 11. That was what was in my printer, you know, and so I needed to be able to print out the book for people. And it was kind of this strange book, you know, but there was something really seductive about the airiness, about the margins, about the, and I think people responded to that.
And you had the drawings before you went to the publisher,
right? Yeah. I mean, I knew I was taking a risk by laying everything out and doing the drawings. I was probably taking someone's job, you know, by doing this. They want the standard 12-point double-space manuscript. But I also knew that in order for them to understand this project, they needed to see it. And really, the only expectations I went in was someone will see this project for what it is and will realize it. That's all I wanted. Mm-hmm. And when I was meeting with certain publishers, you know, again, that I could see them, you know, that it's a difficult time for publishers, and they were like, oh, Barnes & Noble's not going to like a bigger size book. We have to kind of work within certain, you know, limits. And certain publishers like Penguin Press was just like, let's roll with this. This is an asset. You know, people are hungry for something different. And I think people are hungry for something different. You know, if your story is different, keep it different, please. I plead with you, you know, because if there's a freshness to it, you know, people will respond to that. I mean, I still am kind of in shock that people respond to this and get this and want to read it, because part of me is like, I only really wrote it for an audience of one, which was me. You know, I was like, oh, this is kind of funny, or I like this drawing. And it's been really, really cool for me to see that I'm not so weird, you know, that other people respond to McDonald's or whatever it is. And that points to a kind of universality that is, I'm still learning about it, you know, and it makes me want to write another book, I think.
We're all weird. Or maybe, as a friend of mine says, the only people that aren't weird are the ones you don't know very well. Ralph Larson, congratulations, and it's a real pleasure to engage you like this. Good luck with the selected works of T.S. Spivet, the selected works of Ralph Larson.
Thanks, yeah, which I'm continuing to select for.
Good. Keep doing it. Thank you.
Sarah Archambault produced and edited this conversation with Ralph Larson, author of The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. Post up your own guess or theory or dream about the books of the future and what you'd pay for them at our free website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thanks for joining the conversation.